Chapter 6, Teachable Moments in Higher Education. The responsibility of government is to ensure that the young people of the nation receive the best and most appropriate education of which they are capable, and which the community, represented by its government and legislature, can afford to give them. There are few more valid tests of statesmanship than a clear recognition of this important responsibility. Alex Campbell, Policy Statement on Post-Secondary Education, April 2, 1968.
Our young premier has shown himself a very courageous man. Progressive Conservative MLA, J. Russell Driscoll, April 2, 1968.
In January 1968, Alex Campbell gave a television address outlining Prince Edward Island's challenges and prospects and updating islanders on his government's priorities. The twin focal points were the province's grim fiscal circumstances and the optimistic outlook for comprehensive economic development. Campbell did not mention post-secondary education and would not have predicted that it would generate the most heat in the forthcoming legislative session. If there was friction in the post-secondary sector, it was from the foot-dragging of PEI's two universities in response to government expectations that they collaborate. Almost 40 years later, Campbell would rank the transformative changes in post-secondary education announced in April 1968 as a signature accomplishment of his time as premier, at the same time conceding that his government went into that sideways. Campbell says, "We didn't have a manifesto to create a single university. We were dealing with the issues of the day." Like the rest of Canada in the 1960s, Prince Edward Island was facing growing demands for advanced education. PEI's two post-secondary institutions, St. Dunstan's University and Prince of Wales College, both with roots extending to the early decades of the 19th century, had developed on separate but rival paths. The rivalries showed up most visibly in sports, while the academic paths of the two schools were mainly separate. Although there were occasional collaborations, such initiatives were the exception and not the rule. The primary perceived difference between St. Dunstan's and Prince of Wales was on religious grounds. St. Dunstan's was owned by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Charlottetown and had a strong church influence going back to its founding. It did not receive operating funds from government until 1965. Prince of Wales was publicly funded and for most of its history had been treated as an offshoot of the Department of Education. By the second half of the 1960s, the main competition between the two institutions was for primacy in a race to expand and for government funding. On PEI, religion, money, and politics were a troublesome combination, especially for a young premier with a one-seat majority and an empty purse.
Lessons in post-secondary politics.
Alex Campbell did not have to look far over his shoulder for lessons about the incendiary nature of post-secondary politics on Prince Edward Island. The governments of Alex Matheson and Walter Shaw had both been seared by initiatives in the sector. In 1957, Matheson's Liberal government brought forward legislation that would permit St. Dunstan's to offer teachers' licenses through a normal school program. The initiative sought to address a chronic teacher shortage in the face of growing school enrollments. Prince of Wales had been training teachers since 1879, when the college was amalgamated with the provincial normal school. The measure generated bitter debates in the legislature, in the media, and within both political parties. One Liberal member of the legislature gave voice to Protestant fears that this would amount to an invasion of the public school system by sectarian-trained teachers. Education Minister Keir Clark called on the Assembly to put educational advancement ahead of petty bickering over religious differences. The measure passed, however, feelings stirred up by the sectarian political debates continued to smoulder. The Shaw government's searing came in 1964, when it moved to respond to pressures for Prince of Wales College to attain university status and commence offering bachelor's degrees. St. Dunstan's had been offering degree programs since 1917, and prior to that through a collaborative relationship with Laval University. Prince of Wales offered the first 2 years of university, after which students completed their degrees elsewhere. The pressure for PWC to become a university came from diverse sources. In the winter of 1963-64, more than 50 island organizations presented briefs to government. The 1964 speech from the throne announced the creation of a royal commission to inquire into and report upon the organization and financing of university education in this province, and indicated that the government notes with interest the widespread appeals to elevate Prince of Wales to degree-granting status, going on to say that these representations will receive careful consideration. The 1964 throne speech was itself a political compromise. Dr. George Dewar, who as Minister of Education spearheaded the legislative initiative to accord university status to PWC, observed in his memoirs that the speech set the stage for a dramatic struggle. The proposition came close to splitting the Shaw cabinet and caucus. A respite was reached by providing for the legislation to come into effect at an unspecified later date, while awaiting the advice of the Royal Commission. Prince of Wales Principal Dr. Frank MacKinnon was quite displeased, and PWC students marched on the legislature carrying placards reading "Deserted, Disappointed, Disillusioned and Disgusted," and reading "Royal Commission be damned."
The Royal Commission and its aftermath.
The Royal Commission on Higher Education was chaired by Dr. John Sutherland Bunnell, a PEI native and former Prince of Wales student who was president of the New York Theological Seminary. Joining Bunnell were Norman Mackenzie, a native Nova Scotian who had served for 18 years as president of the University of British Columbia, and before that as president of the University of New Brunswick, and Dr. Joseph McMillan, a prominent Charlottetown physician who served as chief of staff at the Charlottetown Hospital. The commission received briefs, including from Prince of Wales and St. Dunstan's, and conducted a broad research program. The commissioners recommended prompt proclamation of the legislation granting university status to Prince of Wales, plus an annual provincial grant of $300 per student to both Prince of Wales and St. Dunstan's. This was the first time that St. Dunstan's would receive an operating grant from the province. On the question of whether the two institutions should become a single university or remain separate, the Royal Commission favoured a federation model on a single campus. After the Commission's report was released in January 1965, it was clear that the two institutions would be under pressure to consider unprecedented levels of cooperation. 2 weeks after the release of the Royal Commission's report, a citizens' committee of prominent islanders that had been meeting since 1964 to study the university question went public and released a proposal for the establishment of a single university on Prince Edward Island. The citizens' committee contended that various concepts of cooperation or federation which had been advanced were, in their words, too vague, too easily misinterpreted, and too easily prostituted toward the maintenance of division and the creation of new barriers producing further division. Following the publication of the single university proposal in January 1965, the committee undertook a vigorous public awareness campaign, going on radio and television programs and meeting with community groups and service clubs. Dr. Malcolm Beck was a co-chair of the Citizens Committee. He recalls that in September 1966, he participated in a meeting in Summerside organized to facilitate community discussions about economic and social issues. Beck was there in his role as Director of Mental Health. In breakout sessions, groups were invited to propose actions in the form of resolutions. Dr. Beck's table proposed that Prince Edward Island should have a single university. Alex Campbell, who attended as MLA for the district and recently elected Premier, was asked to make some general remarks. Campbell had been leafing through the resolutions, and he pulled out the single university proposal, saying he would like to have an expression of opinion, asking those in favour to stand up. Dr. Beck said, "I damn near died. The whole bloody room stood up with one accord, and then we sat down and he asked those who opposed it to stand, and I think there were only four." In October 1966, Dr. John Maloney, who along with Beck was co-chair of the Citizens Committee, spoke to the Charlottetown Rotary Club. He reported that the citizens' group had brought the single university question to approximately 1,200 people and that the response had been overwhelmingly in favour, with only two people openly in opposition. According to Maloney, the opposition lay in the boards and faculties of both universities and in religious intolerance. In characteristically straight-spoken fashion, Maloney observed, "We are living in a world where interpersonal, interracial, and interreligious tolerance must be learned if the world is not to destroy itself. And it is to the university that one looks to teach this tolerance to our children. and they haven't even learned to speak to each other. In fact, many of the faculty members of the two universities wouldn't recognize each other if they passed on the street.
PWC and SDU Actions and Reactions.
Notwithstanding the popular support reported by Dr. Maloney, Prince of Wales and St. Dunstan's barely acknowledged the proselytizing of the Citizens Committee. Both institutions were energetically expanding programs and infrastructure, recruiting new faculty and staff, and approaching government for additional financial support. Prince of Wales planned to add the third year of university studies in 1967 and the fourth year in 1968. With the completion of the province's new system of senior high schools in 1966, PWC and SDU phased out their grade 11 and grade 12 offerings. In this environment of dynamic change and expansion, the question of interinstitutional cooperation received modest attention, with no serious move on the part of either institution to achieve federation, let alone amalgamation. After several meetings and considerable debate, the PWC Board of Governors decided in late summer of 1966 to proceed with the establishment of Prince of Wales as a degree-granting university at its present site, with the facilities necessary for that purpose. The board further decided that, during the interim period, this should not preclude discussion or negotiation for cooperation between PWC, SDU, and other universities. In other words, they would go it alone. In the Prince of Wales board discussions, Principal Dr. Frank McKinnon compared federation to running a three-legged race. The board decided that its position would be kept very confidential. In July 1966, the boards of SDU and PWC had their first joint meeting. This was an historic occasion, but not much was accomplished. Prince of Wales historian Marion Bruce writes, "Like red-faced prospects for an arranged marriage, the two boards exchanged polite, non-committal pleasantries." Dr. Malcolm Beck says that the meeting bombed, explaining, "There was nothing but fatuous generalities uttered between them. Not one worthwhile idea was passed between the whole kit and caboodle of them." A second joint meeting was held in November, resulting in an agreement to study areas of cooperation between the two institutions. However, the following day, Prince of Wales announced its intention, as decided by its board in September, to develop independently. Premier Campbell, who was asked about the PWC announcement upon returning from the Atlantic Winter Fair, used judicious language, but it was clear that he was not amused. He noted the apparent conflict between the Prince of Wales' statement of its intention to develop independently and the report of the previous day's joint PWC-SDU board meeting. He said that the government has been devoting much time to the matter of financing higher education in the province and had anticipated entering into close cooperation with the joint boards with a view to developing long-term plans. Campbell cautioned, "It is hoped that these plans will not be jeopardized by any unilateral decisions." Campbell's disappointment over PWC's unilateral approach was exacerbated by the fact that he had invited Dr. Frank McKinnon of PWC and Father George MacDonald of SDU to join him and Education Minister Gordon Bennett as part of the PEI delegation at the Fiscal Conference on Tax Sharing held in Ottawa the previous week. The agenda for the Ottawa conference included consideration of transfers for post-secondary education. The collateral purpose of inviting MacDonald and McKinnon was to build informal relationships, including between the two men. In comments to the PEI media in conjunction with the Ottawa meetings, Campbell was reported as saying that while he favored one university, he had an open mind on the way that this would come about, whether through actual amalgamation or some form of federation of the two existing universities. Paraphrasing the 1965 Bladen Commission report on financing higher education, Campbell said that he felt strongly that we should achieve excellence without extravagance. The leadership of St. Dunstan's was open to federation, but not amalgamation, and was proceeding cautiously. The Prince of Wales announcement in November 1966 caught SDU unawares, and was doubly aggravating as it came a day after the joint board meeting hosted by St. Dunstan's. At a December 6th meeting, the SDU Board of Governors voted to table the matter. Shortly thereafter, St. Dunstan's president, Father George MacDonald, wrote an open letter describing the proposals of the amalgamationists as being even less acceptable educationally, politically, and theologically than they had been when first made public, and dismissing arguments based on economics by declaring, an honorable demise is preferable to the proposed sellout. In the spring of 1966, the St. Dunstan's student newspaper, The Red and White, conducted a survey on the two campuses, asking PWC and SDU students, "Do you want PWC and SDU to amalgamate and form a UPEI?" At Prince of Wales, 30% of students said yes, 43% said no, and 27% were indifferent. St. Dunstan's students were more decidedly in favor, with 73% saying yes, 13% being against amalgamation, and 14% being indifferent. The students were clearly more open to a UPEI than the leadership of their respective institutions. That the Prince of Wales students were less favorably disposed than those at St. Dunstan's can perhaps be explained by three factors. That amalgamation or federation would most likely mean a physical move for PWC. That the PWC students had recently been through the political battle in favor of attaining university status. And that Prince of Wales students were more actively mobilized by professors and institutional leaders than was the case at St. Dunstan's. In their comparative openness to change, the students had a kindred spirit in the Right Reverend Malcolm McCachern, the Bishop of Charlottetown. McCachern wrote to Premier Campbell on November 21, 1966, offering to meet, to discuss with you in an informal manner ways and means of providing university education of the highest caliber possible for and in the interests of all young men and women seeking knowledge in our province. Campbell responded the following day to what he termed the bishop's thoughtful letter and indicated a willingness to meet after the special fall session of the legislature was completed. When they met in early December, McCachern told Campbell about a document titled Thoughts on the Future Role of St. Dunstan's in Higher Education in Prince Edward Island that he would distribute to members of the St. Dunstan's Board of Governors at their December 6th meeting, and that he would send with the proviso, confidential and not for publication, to all priests in the diocese on December 12th. The four-page document refers to some thoughts floating around and opens with the statement, "Many citizens of Prince Edward Island, both Catholic and Protestant, feel it is not feasible or desirable to have two separate and competing universities in the province. Whether they like it or not, it must be recognized that this is the situation we are now approaching."
The race to expand.
While Prince Edward Island's two universities were taking a standoffish approach to cooperation, much less either federation or amalgamation, they were both proceeding aggressively with physical expansion plans and with growth in programs and operations. Neither institution had the resources to keep pace with the envisaged growth. This was especially the case for Prince of Wales. In early 1967, SDU and PWC each met with Cabinet to speak about their independent plans for growth and to plead for additional financial support from government. The institutions presented multi-year expansion plans totaling more than $10 million each, far beyond the fiscal capacity or tolerance of a cash-strapped government. Through this same period, the Campbell government struggled with the financial situation at the Confederation Centre of the Arts. The arts complex had been built in the early 1960s and opened in 1964 as a memorial to the Fathers of Confederation. The construction of the complex was led by Dr. Frank McKinnon, who succeeded in securing capital contributions from all 10 provinces and from the federal government. When the Campbell government came to office, they learned that the center was incurring debts and that combined annual government grants of $200,000 were insufficient to cover the costs of operation and maintenance. In October 1966, the center's board of directors, chaired by Dr. McKinnon, held an emergency meeting and decided to cease operations on November 5th if additional government funds were not forthcoming. While the impending closure was staved off by last-ditch increases in federal and provincial funding, the finances of the center would be an ongoing issue. On May 4, 1967, Frank McKinnon wrote to Premier Campbell requesting an increase in the center's annual grant, offering in support the argument, "The island gets far more than $175,000 back in benefits and in cash. Indeed, for every dollar the island spends on the center, it gets back $5, and the center is one of the most productive enterprises the province has ever had." In the 1967 legislative session, Education Minister Gordon Bennett introduced a bill to establish the University's Coordinating Council, or the UCC, composed of five representatives of each university and four named by government.
Lauren most recalls attending the inaugural meeting of the UCC in September 1967 as one of his first activities after being named Acting Deputy Minister of Education. While most says that he was still wet behind the ears, he remembers thinking, this isn't going anywhere. Education Minister Gordon Bennett attended the first meeting and made a substantive presentation. He noted that all Canadian provinces had established similar coordinating bodies, as governments assume an increasing financial role in university education, not least because the federal government had agreed to flow post-secondary funding to provincial governments rather than directly to universities. Bennett presented a wide-ranging assessment of post-secondary developments in Canada and elsewhere. His enthusiastic comments were not reciprocated by the UCC, which adjourned after agreeing to establish a joint committee to select recipients of centennial scholarships that had been recently funded by the provincial government. The UCC met on two further occasions, but little was accomplished.
The University's Grants Commission.
The speech from the throne opening the 1968 session of the legislature announced that there would be substantial increases in per capita student grants to island universities. The speech also announced that government would bring in legislation to establish a University Grants Commission, or UGC, with power to make recommendations on institutional funding. In preparation for the session, Lauren Mose had been asked by Gordon Bennett to find out what's going on across the country. After reviewing the arrangements in other jurisdictions, it was decided that the Manitoba legislation, with adaptations, would best meet the needs of Prince Edward Island. On Tuesday, March 26th, Education Minister Bennett introduced Bill 57 to establish the University Grants Commission. The reaction from Prince of Wales was instantaneous. On Wednesday, the legislative galleries were packed with PWC students, who also staged a sit-in on the steps of the Confederation Center and went door-to-door with petitions. As Alex Campbell recalled the events almost 40 years later, all hell broke loose. Labor Minister Elmer Blanchard wrote in his diary on Wednesday, March 27th, "Protests against Bill 57 have started. Students are filling the galleries. Frank McKinnon and his hardcore of faculty members are leading the troops." There were further demonstrations on Thursday and Friday. Petitions were circulated, and the daily papers carried letters to the editor. The March 27th edition of the Eastern Graphic reported that students from PWC were on hand after a concert in Montague, seeking support for a petition objecting to the University Grants Commission because it would ensure political interference in education at Prince of Wales. Throughout this period, the key players were in regular communication. On March 26th, the day the UGC bill was introduced, Education Minister Gordon Bennett noted in his diary that he had been at Frank McKinnon's with John Gillis till 3 a.m. Gillis was PWC's board chair. On March 27th, McKinnon wrote a strong letter to Bennett opposing Bill 57 as being too wide in scope, saying, "It would be like calling in a fire engine to put out a cigar." Later the same day, the Education Minister met with SDU Rector Father George MacDonald. From Alex Campbell's perspective, the matter was not complicated. The government was openly concerned about escalating financial requests from the two institutions, and the UGC was a minimum requirement to keep a handle on the situation. Campbell recalls, "Really, in essence, it was economics. It was making sense out of money invested in post-secondary education. We had proposals from the two institutions for libraries, for labs, for music departments. Cooperation between the two institutions having bogged down, we took the only option that was open to us." In the face of the animated protests against Bill 57, the pathway was narrowing. Campbell later recalled, "There were no alternatives suggested. Just get rid of it. Withdraw. And we were all there with our backs to the wall, and there were no escape routes. It was withdraw or else."
The Single University.
Late in the evening of March 28th, after the House rose at 10 p.m., Alex Campbell and Gordon Bennett met for several hours. Bennett noted in his diary, "Galleries again filled with students. Caucus in evening, re-Bill 57. Alex and I at building till 2 a.m. The late-night conversation between Campbell and his Minister of Education was an important tipping point. While Gordon Bennett could see the need for a much greater degree of cooperation than either PWC or SDU was ready to undertake, he had up to that point remained on the fence. Bennett was almost certainly not an amalgamationist, having spent his career prior to his 1966 entry into politics as a professor, varsity coach, and registrar at Prince of Wales, where his father had also been a long-time teacher. Whatever may have been the probable scenarios up to that point, it was clear by the early morning hours of March 29th that, faced with a strident lobby against the University Grants Commission and the manifest failure of PwC and SDU to achieve any substantive cooperation, there was nothing to be gained by proceeding with Bill 57. Further, with the legislature to adjourn the following Tuesday for a two-week recess, the matter had to be brought to a head. With a majority of only one seat in the legislature, Alex Campbell concluded, "We hit our backs to the wall." It is telling about Alex Campbell's sanguine nature and his firm but generous leadership that Gordon Bennett concludes his diary entry about the meeting with Campbell that lasted until 2 a.m. with a touching note, "Little gift from ABC for trying." When the legislature convened on Friday morning, PwC students again filled the galleries. Gordon Bennett was on the floor with spending estimates for the Department of Education. During a break between the morning and afternoon sessions, Alex Campbell presented caucus with his assessment that Bill 57 was a dead letter and that, even if the UGC legislation could be forced through, it would achieve no purpose. Government members were receiving pressure from all quarters on the university's issue. Campbell shared his view that the only viable path forward was a single university with significant public investment. After some discussion, caucus agreed unanimously on the proposed course of action. Gordon Bennett indicated his support for this momentous decision. It was agreed that Premier Campbell, along with Gordon Bennett and Elmer Blanchard, would meet during the weekend with Dr. John Gillis as chair of the PwC board and with Bishop McCachern on behalf of SDU to obtain reaction, and that work would be done over the weekend on a policy statement to be considered by caucus on Monday. Elmer Blanchard's views on the proposed course of action are telling in several important respects. Blanchard was Gordon Bennett's running mate in the dual constituency of Fifth Queens. The two men lived two houses apart on Upper Prince Street and had been elected together in 1966. Blanchard's father, like Bennett's, was a longtime teacher at Prince of Wales, and Blanchard himself had been a student and star hockey player at both PwC and SDU. Notwithstanding how close the two men were, Blanchard was unsure whether Bennett would support a single university. Writing in his diary about the Friday afternoon caucus meeting, Blanchard commented, "Gordon Bennett has agreed wholeheartedly to the proposal. I had often thought that this would be a splitting of the ways between us if the issue had to be determined, and I am glad that he has agreed to this point of view." On the merits of a single university, Blanchard was clear. "I personally feel that this strong action is a must. Otherwise, with PEI's limited resources, we would have two third- or fourth-rate universities."
The policy statement.
Friday's caucus decision led to an action-filled weekend. On Saturday, Premier Campbell, Gordon Bennett, and Elmer Blanchard met with Bishop Malcolm McCachern in the morning and had dinner later in the day with Dr. John Gillis. Blanchard records that Bishop McCachern gave us the green light on the project, and that Gillis's reaction was excellent. The main work of the weekend for Campbell and his team was to prepare the policy statement on post-secondary education to be presented to caucus on Monday and to the legislature on Tuesday. The policy statement was primarily the handiwork of a trio from the Economic Improvement Corporation, Del Gallagher, Richard Higgins, and Eugene Chatterton. EIC had been working on a comprehensive education plan, which was discussed with Gordon Bennett on March 11th and which Bennett presented to caucus on March 20th. In the course of preparing the education plan, which focused on changes in primary and secondary education, Higgins and Chatterton had been looking at the post-secondary aspect and had done substantial analysis of developments in other jurisdictions. With the realization by Campbell and the government that the single university was the only path forward, the EIC's background work quickly came to the fore. Between Friday, March 29th, when the Liberal caucus affirmed that it would back a single university, and Monday, April 1st, Gallagher, Higgins, and Chatterton worked around the clock, as did Andy Wells. Higgins focused on the references to elementary and secondary education and on a new College of Applied Arts and Technology. Chatterton worked on the university aspect, including comparative data from across Canada, and on student aid issues. Gallagher crafted the document in close collaboration with Andy Wells. Campbell and Wells ensured that the document was well-tuned politically and was cast in language that would work for its broader audience. That included, as Campbell recalls, taking out repeated use of the word viable. A tricky aspect of the policy statement was to determine how to tie it in with the Comprehensive Development Plan, still 11 months from being signed. Gallagher felt that they had to go for broke, knowing that they had the support of senior federal officials at his level, but without ministerial or higher political approval from Ottawa. With this audacious assumption, the centerpiece of the policy statement became a promised investment of $120 million over a 10-year period, including $18 million for student aid, $30 million for the College of Applied Arts and Technology, and $69 million for the single university. The final delicate feature was to address the relationship between government and the post-secondary institutions. This aspect was handled mainly by Wells and Campbell, with confirmation from Gordon Bennett. By Monday, after the legislative sitting concluded at 10 p.m., the policy statement was presented to the government caucus. There was extensive discussion to gain an appreciation of the details, but no dissension on the merits. In his diary, Elmer Blanchard recorded, "Everything has gelled and the Premier will make the statement tomorrow morning, home at 12:15. When the legislature sat on Tuesday morning, the galleries were packed with students, mainly from PwC, and with members of the public. The Premier's office had sent out a media release late Sunday indicating that there would be a major announcement on post-secondary education on Tuesday. The students had been in the galleries during Monday's legislative sessions and had gone to selected Protestant churches on Sunday to urge opposition to Bill 57. Elmer Blanchard wrote regarding Tuesday morning in the legislature, "Prior to the session, the air could be cut with a knife. Electricity seemed to permeate the chamber." When Alex Campbell rose at 10:15 a.m. to make the policy statement, he did not know how the opposition or the public would react. Opposition leader Walter Shaw had been given a briefing Tuesday morning. Campbell recalls, "I could feel my heart resounding in my boots. I speculated on how opposition members might react. How would the people of Prince Edward Island react? Would my own caucus remain unanimous? Only time would tell." Campbell spoke from 10:15 until 11:45 a.m. Elmer Blanchard wrote in his diary, "The Premier presented a masterful proposition." Del Gallagher and his team were downstairs in the EIC offices listening on the public address system. Richard Higgins recalls, "It was a master class in strategic policy and politics. The Premier rose to the occasion and shone under the incredible pressure placed on him." Premier Campbell opened his address by observing that higher education and the government's relationship to higher education had been a difficult problem on Prince Edward Island for many years.
"Mr. Speaker, higher education and the government's relationship to higher education has been a difficult problem in this province for many years. This legislature has debated this question, governments have considered it, and royal commissions have studied it. Different points of view on higher education have been developed by opposing sides, and unfortunately, too often such words as prejudice, bigotry, and fear have been used by all sides in the lower levels of discussion. There is more at stake here than perhaps any of us has realized, and this must include the government as well. Protests against the mechanics and details of this legislation are both understandable and welcome, but as yet there has not been one formal suggestion from those who object to the bill as to how it might be amended, either in principle or in detail. Instead, the demand is for no commission, for no priority assessment, and for no governmental influence in the development and direction of higher education. All of these, the Grants Commission, the need for priority assessment, and government influence, have been totally and completely rejected by the opponents to this bill. This, then, is the issue, Mr. Speaker, and it must be properly and clearly stated. I think the time has come when we and the government, as representatives of the taxpayers of the province, must cease to merely serve the interests of institutions of higher education and ask ourselves how these institutions can best serve the needs of the province and, in particular, the needs of our youth. It is this question and these needs which are the issues before us, and they are more important than a mere grants commission or the institutions themselves, including the people who administer them. These issues are also more important and above considerations of politics or religion or money or, in fact, the political fate of this present government.
Campbell acknowledged the protests against Bill 57 and congratulated the students on exercising their right to protest responsibly. He then launched into a nuanced reflection on the roles and responsibilities of universities and government, citing numerous commissions and studies, and he assessed the empirical situation on Prince Edward Island, forecasting continued growth and demand for post-secondary education. Campbell noted the challenges faced by PwC and SDU to adequately finance their current operations plus their expansion plans, and said that a continuation of the existing uncoordinated and fragmented expansion program of these two universities can only lead to further duplication and increased costs per student. He said that while one of the institutions had rejected out of hand government's attempt to encourage coordination, the government could not walk away from the problem. Campbell then hit the heart of his presentation and his premiership with these words.
I would suggest, Mr. Speaker, and through you to the members of this House and to the citizens of our province, that we cannot be content to remain just as we are. Our position is not good enough now, and is not good enough for our children. I firmly believe that our province is now at the point in its history where the province must decide to break the chains of the past and make a bold, imaginative, and courageous thrust into the future. We must not only be dissatisfied with the present situation, but what is more, we must be ready, indeed eager, to explore new ideas, new methods, new avenues, and new and bold dimensions in all our programs and services, if our province is to move into the future and bring about a better life for all our citizens.
Premier Campbell emphasized that the anticipated move forward required a willingness to accept change, and said that young people should be the first to welcome change, both intellectually and emotionally. In the final stages of his address, Campbell announced the three-part post-secondary program, comprising student aid, a single university of non-denominational character, and a college or institute of applied arts and technology. He said that government intended to move forward as quickly as possible to introduce legislation, to work with the boards of PwC and SDU, and to provide the opportunity for public and private opinion to be expressed. Campbell said that integration would not be forced upon the existing institutions, which were entitled to continue as private entities, but that the government would support financially, with all the funds at its disposal, only a single public university in Prince Edward Island. He concluded with these words, "It will be our university and our program for the island, a university that can grow as we grow, and one that all islanders can support, utilize, and cherish."
Reaction.
When Campbell started his address, he was unsure how it would be received. Early in his statement, he said that the question of how to best serve the needs of the province, and in particular the needs of our youth, for post-secondary education was above considerations of politics or religion or money or, in fact, the political fate of this present government. If he was concerned that the government might fall, Campbell did not have to wait long for reassurance. He received a resounding ovation on the floor of the House. After dealing briefly with routine business, the legislature adjourned for a two-week break, to include Easter, the Federal Liberal Leadership Convention, and the preparation of legislation. The first MLA to cross the floor to congratulate Campbell was J. David Stewart, whose opinion counted highly in the provincial business community and in the Conservative Party. Former Premier Shaw was quoted in the afternoon journal Pioneer as saying that the Premier's statement was comprehensive, far-reaching, and almost startling. J. Russell Driscoll, a conservative MLA with St. Dunstan's connections, was quoted as saying to reporters outside the legislature, "Our young premier has shown himself to be a very courageous man." John Brahoe, a recent PwC graduate working at CFCY Radio, recalls someone in the newsroom blurting out, "Gutsy little bastard, isn't he?" Dr. Frank MacKinnon responded quickly and angrily, commenting that the premier's announcement was a fatal blow to us at Prince of Wales and calling it a shotgun wedding by proxy. Alex Campbell, obviously feeling a sense of relief following the policy statement, quipped when asked in an interview about MacKinnon's comments, "I always thought there was a pregnancy involved in a shotgun wedding. I wonder when the two had an opportunity to get together." Elmer Blanchard recorded in his April 2nd diary, "This is one of the red-letter days in PEI history, and I'm proud to be a member of the government that made a courageous political decision." There would be no dissension within the Liberal caucus. Among a stream of congratulatory letters from the community, one of the first came from Prince Edward Island's Lieutenant Governor, WJR Billy Archie MacDonald, a longtime teacher at Prince of Wales and a known advocate of a single university, who congratulated Campbell on what he called his splendid address. Dr. Regis Duffy, chair of the chemistry department at St. Dunstan's, wrote with warmth and wisdom, "We hope that the anguish of birth will be short and look forward to a new humanism, one that will foster material and spiritual growth among our people. You can be assured of my support." Not surprisingly, Drs. John Maloney and Malcolm Beck wrote as co-chairman of the university study group to endorse the government's action in declaring a far-seeing and forthright policy. Within a few days, if not hours, it was clear that the tide of opinion was running strongly in favour of Campbell. This included Prince of Wales partisans, such as lawyer Alan Scales, who had been a member of the 1962 committee urging university status for PwC. Scales reflected 45 years later when asked about Alex Campbell's biggest achievements.
"One of the big things that Alex Campbell did was in education and what he did with the university. I was involved with PwC and Frank MacKinnon, and he got a lot of people on side. When Alex Campbell decided, there was an announcement that there would be something said in the House the next day. I don't think anyone expected him to say that there would be one university. I remember I took the PwC side, but when that came out, it was for the long-term benefit. Frank MacKinnon was going to have the separate university. Frank was a great promoter, but had absolutely no regard for finances at all. He was determined that he was going to buy all the property along Kent Street. I suppose Alex Campbell got scared when he heard about this. You would too."
The Board of Prince of Wales met on April 10th and passed a resolution confirming that it would enter into discussion with the government of Prince Edward Island with a view to the development and maintenance of the best system of university education in this province. The board asked for assurance that the transition would be carried out in an orderly way, that the programs and degrees of current PwC students would be protected, and that commitments to faculty and staff would be honoured. Campbell lauded the spirit of cooperation implicit in the board's resolution. The chair of the board at St. Dunstan's wrote Campbell on April 13th, confirming the willingness of SDU's executive committee to proceed. Not everyone was happy. Dr. Frank MacKinnon tendered his resignation, as did a number of Prince of Wales faculty and staff. Jack McAndrew, who in 1968 was publicity director at the Confederation Centre and a political commentator on CBC, recalls the events in succinct terms. "To me, one of the greatest statesmanlike things I've ever observed in a PEI politician was the day that Alex Campbell got up in the House and proclaimed his post-secondary policy. It took a lot of courage. But once Frank MacKinnon took on Campbell in the public sphere, he had to lose, because Alex had to win."
The birth of Holland College.
A fundamental feature of Campbell's policy statement on post-secondary education went almost unnoticed amidst all the fanfare about the single university. While it took fewer words in the policy statement and occupied less of the political limelight, the commitment to create a new college of applied arts and technology was at least as visionary as the provincial university, especially in light of Prince Edward Island's modest precedence in this area. Campbell told the legislature that the new college would remedy a long-standing deficiency in our post-secondary educational system and would be developed to meet both provincial and regional needs. Above all, it would significantly increase the opportunities available to our students. The government moved quickly to implement the new post-secondary structures by bringing in legislation to create the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Dr. E.F. Ted Sheffield of the University of Toronto was named to advise the government on post-secondary developments and to preside over a comprehensive planning process. It was clear from the outset that the planning process would be at arm's length from government. By midsummer, the membership of two planning committees was announced, an 11-member college planning committee, chaired initially by Dr. Sheffield, and an 11-member university planning committee, of which he was also chair. Department of Education officials, Commander E.T. Jim Jeffries and Ivan McKenzie, served as secretaries to the college and university planning committees, respectively. While the University Planning Committee was mainly charged with ironing out wrinkles of bringing together two existing institutions, the College Planning Committee had a greenfield opportunity. There were no controlling precedents on Prince Edward Island. The Prince County Vocational Institute had been established in Summerside in 1962 and the Provincial Vocational Institute in Charlottetown in 1963. It was clear from the outset that the new College of Applied Arts and Technology would be a more ambitious undertaking. When the College Planning Committee looked beyond Prince Edward Island, there was no conventional model to be borrowed or copied. The existing initiatives in neighboring provinces were weak, with no independence. In effect, they were branches of the Department of Education or Manpower. The Planning Committee decided to look further afield, conducting three study tours, one to the Maritimes, Ontario and Quebec, one to the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology and the British Columbia Institute of Technology, and a third tour to visit American institutions. The group that visited the United States found knockouts at Miami-Dade Junior College in Florida and Oakland Community College in Michigan, just outside Detroit. Richard Higgins says that these institutions became the model for Holland College. Connie Cullen, who was a student member of the College Planning Committee, participated in the tour of United States colleges and found Miami-Dade to be a revelation. She says, "They were proud of what they did and zealous in promoting vocationally relevant curricula and teaching and assessment methods." Cullen says the American tour made what we were doing feel innovative and socially relevant. She found the work of the College Planning Committee creative and exciting, and says that she never found that her ideas were discounted because she was a student and 18 years old. One of the central decisions of the College Planning Committee, whose mandate included recommending the key provisions of what would become the Holland College Act, was that the new college should have its own board of governors and a status independent from government. At the time, this was breaking new ground, especially in Atlantic Canada. A second defining feature was that the new college would take students who had completed grade 12 and were looking for post-secondary training, thereby differentiating the college from existing vocational institutes or the Cégep model in Quebec. The planning committee also decided on a name for the college to honor Samuel Holland, who in his role as Surveyor General of British North America had in 1765 prepared the earliest and still definitive map of Prince Edward Island.
Struggle over Holland College's location.
Even as it handed its recommendations for constituting legislation to government, the College Planning Committee was dealing with an even hotter issue, where to locate the new Holland College. As a member of the Planning Committee named by the Summerside Board of Trade, businessman Fred Heineman saw an opportunity for Summerside to become the primary site for the college. He and Richard Noonan, the principal of Summerside High School, prepared a very powerful brief to the planning committee, contending that with the university going to Charlottetown, it would create a powerful equilibrium to have the college in Summerside, including giving local students the option to complete their first year of post-secondary studies at home before going on to the University of Prince Edward Island. Heineman says that Charlottetown caught wind of this and prepared a competing brief that was pretty much cribbed from the Summerside submission. Charlottetown went public with its presentation to the Planning Committee, which was made jointly by Mayor Dorothy Corrigan and Robert Smith, President of the Board of Trade. They argued that Charlottetown was the growth center and would produce more high school graduates than other potential locations, a point that was helped by combining all graduates from Queens and Kings counties. The most forceful point made by Mayor Corrigan was that the new college could capitalize on the site and facilities of Prince of Wales College, arguing that to construct new facilities elsewhere would waste millions of dollars. Corrigan said that it would be folly to build a new infrastructure at present inflated construction costs and high interest rates on capital borrowings. Shortly thereafter, on Easter Friday, Conservative leader George Key came out in favor of locating Holland College in Summerside, arguing that government should locate services and facilities at various centres throughout the province, and that a Summerside location for Holland College would establish a creative balance and choice in post-secondary education. On the previous evening, on Easter Thursday, Education Minister Gordon Bennett had quietly received the College Planning Committee's recommendation that Charlottetown should be the site. The recommendation was arrived at following an acrimonious debate and a close vote within the committee. On Easter Monday, Alex Campbell had a two-page letter from his brother Mel, who wrote to the Premier frequently and frankly on matters of public policy and politics. The younger Campbell brother wrote, "I think it has been stated that you and Earl have as yet to produce any development for Summerside, and the placement of the college would certainly be a big step towards your re-election. It has been suggested that if the college did not come, or if something equivalent did not come to Summerside, then the chances of your election would be very much diminished." By the following week, everyone was going public. The Summerside Kinsmen Club and the Board of Trade issued statements. Steps were taken to organize meetings of concern in Summerside and throughout Prince County under the auspices of the Royal Canadian Legion. On April 14th, there was an astute editorial in the journal Pioneer, likely the work of the paper's able publisher, Elmer Murphy, saying, "It is known that there is a bit of a tug-of-war in Cabinet between Gordon Bennett, who is known to be determined that the college will be located in Charlottetown, and Messrs. Campbell and Hickey, who are not so much pushing as being pushed." On April 17th, a delegation of 40 representatives from Summerside and other Prince County communities met with Cabinet at 10 p.m. after the sitting of the legislature. The delegation included representatives of organizations as diverse as the Abrams Village St. Thomas Aquinas Society, the Prince County Ministerial Association, the Ladies' Aid of the Prince County Hospital, and the Junior Chamber of Commerce. Premier Campbell was reported as saying, "The government wants to consider all the pertinent factors." A newspaper account reported that Campbell said if he were speaking only as one of the members for Fifth Prince, he would have no trouble expressing a preference. But as head of the government, he must be more objective. The lobbying efforts came to a head in a consummate meeting of concern called by the Summerside Board of Trade on May 29th. There were 1,200 people present, with a plethora of community organizations represented. The Royal Canadian Legion marched in a body to the high school, led by the Presbyterian Pipe Band. There were numerous clergy in attendance, plus people and organizations from throughout Prince County. There were 6 prepared speeches, plus 29 people who voluntarily mounted the stage to express their own strong feelings. Robert Skuurman was chairman. In opening remarks, he indicated that the meeting was to be non-political and requested that all speakers abide by this rule. According to the journal Pioneer, no one violated the instruction. Premier Campbell, Earl Hickey, and Gordon Bennett were on the stage. While Campbell was cool on the surface, he was obviously on the political hot seat. Considering that Campbell and Hickey had been elected with majorities of 277 and 200 votes respectively in the 1966 election, a well-organized crowd of 1,200 stirred-up citizens warranted careful attention. Moreover, depending on how Alex Campbell handled the situation, it was not improbable that either Gordon Bennett or Earl Hickey or both might feel it necessary to resign, in which case the government would fall. Campbell's remarks were careful and direct, although not what the crowd wanted to hear. At the outset, he stated, "As a citizen, I am concerned, but as Premier, I want to listen." After accepting a copy of a resolution from Board of Trade President Lauren Ramsey, Campbell said, "Summerside means a great deal to me. It is my home and where I shall raise my family, where they will go to school and where I hope they will go to college." He noted that centralization had come to take on sinister connotations, but observed that Summerside had been the beneficiary of centralization as its population grew between 1961 and 1966, while the population of communities west of Summerside had dwindled. He said the town's constant fear of losing the airbase had become a decided hindrance to our development. We rely on the airbase and other government activity for much of our prosperity, and yet this often acts like a pair of blinders on a horse. Every time the federal government or provincial government or one of their agencies makes a move, it sends shivers of despair up and down our collective spines. Campbell noted several prominent developments in the works or on the horizon for Summerside. A new district high school, a new recreational complex just west of town, a processing plant looking at tripling capacity and requiring enhanced port facilities, and a former fur farm targeted to become an agricultural museum eligible for federal grants. The most dissonant note of the evening came with the suggestion by Campbell that it would not be necessary to make a final decision on the location of the college for 2 years. This prompted an editorial in the journal Pioneer, noting that it seemed strange that this had not previously been mentioned and was at odds with the mandate of the College Planning Committee, which had already made a recommendation. The editorial concluded by commenting that Campbell hasn't said anything as to his own opinions, feeling apparently that this is not appropriate to his position as Premier, which makes mincemeat of the political appeal that it is valuable to have a constituency represented by the head of government. In the end, the government deferred to the recommendation of the College Planning Committee, and Holland College's main campus was established on the former Prince of Wales site in Charlottetown. That Alex Campbell and Earl Hickey were re-elected less than a year later with substantially enhanced majorities might suggest that Summerside voters recognized they were in a tight spot, being asked to overrule an arm's-length committee. Robert Skuurman, who chaired the May 29th meeting, was elected in 1970 in the neighboring 4th Prince District with an even bigger majority. When asked about the struggle over Holland College's location more than 4 decades after the event, Alex Campbell reflected that he would have been criticized more severely and justly for overturning the recommendation of the College Planning Committee than he was for not looking after his constituency.
Postludes.
The post-secondary developments of 1968-69 produced 3 noteworthy postludes. First, within weeks of the Summerside Meeting of Concern, Alex Campbell and Earl Hickey set in motion a reassignment of $5 million in development plan funds toward urban development, an area that was not originally targeted by the CDP. With an initiative from the Summerside Board of Trade involving some of the key players who were behind the meetings of concern, the Summerside Waterfront Development Corporation was created. One of the early initiatives of the Waterfront Development Corporation was a land assembly and reclamation project which became the location for a waterfront mall. This reclamation project became, in 2012, the site for Holland College's Summerside campus. The second postlude came in January 1970, when UPEI students had what their yearbook described as their first opportunity to rally around a common cause. When student leaders learned that the university was planning to increase tuition by $100 and to raise other fees, they invited Campbell and Gordon Bennett to a meeting on campus. The Guardian reported that they were greeted warmly by almost 400 students, while the campus yearbook Nexus said the visit brought only vague answers to student demands. The students decided to back up their advocacy for a bursary program with a march to the offices of the Department of Education, which they billed as the largest delegation ever to congregate before a government office in PEI's history. The march turned into a one-day sit-in by almost 200 students. Student Union President John Keaveney says that they marched to the seat of government, but not against it, and that Bennett greeted the student occupiers warmly and with genuine affection. When Alex Campbell came by, the students were struck by his warmth and calm manner, and Keaveney says, "We were assured that he had heard us and would do his best to meet our needs." When it came closing time at the end of the workday, the students departed peaceably. A month later, the speech from the throne announced a bursary program for university and college students and indicated that the program would be substantially enlarged in the ensuing year. The third postlude came in 1977, as the University of Prince Edward Island was conducting a search for its second president to succeed Ron Baker. Alex Campbell's name was suggested in response to a general call for nominations. Search Committee co-chair James Larkin wrote to Campbell, who responded to say that he was honored to be approached but had other commitments, obviously referring to the forthcoming 1978 election.
Final words.
3 weeks after the policy statement on post-secondary education, the journal Pioneer ran an editorial titled "No Longer Controversial," reflecting on the developments and the lessons to be learned. It concluded with the view that what has happened in this matter of higher education in Prince Edward Island should be an object lesson to all people in public life and in private life for that matter. Where there is leadership, great things can be done.